Welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. My guest this week is Charlie Cochran, but before we get to her interview, as always, we're going to hear a review from Justine Adamick. Justine, what do you have for us this week?
Well, continuing in our effort to take a look at the Lambda Literary finalists, I picked up The Fourth Courier by Timothy J. Smith this week. And let me just tell you, I read his biography after I read the book, and I found it most interesting. He's done very interesting things. Let me read you just a snippet of his biography. An unparalleled international career that saw him smuggle banned plays from behind the Iron Curtain, maneuver through occupied territories, represent the U.S. at the highest level of foreign government, and stow away aboard a devil's barge for a three-day crossing from Cape Verde that landed him in an African jail.
Well, he hasn't had a boring life.
That's certainly true. And it was not a boring book.
Okay, good.
It reminded me of a Tom Clancy book or a Robert Ludlum book or even Clive Cussler, the main character is an FBI agent who strikes me as a bit of a Dirk Pitt type with a lovely young woman on his arm along the way. You know how James Bond has a different woman in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's set in Poland in 1992. He's sent over there to when the bunch of murders show up on the shores of a Polish river out near the border. And the third murder, the guy has a trace of radiation on his hand, so they think they're smuggling nuclear weapons. And the FBI agent is sent over to help them solve this murder. And one of the secondary characters is a CIA agent who is using the embassy as a cover. The CIA agent is gay, and he uses his sexuality to lure in the bad guy and get secrets out of him during the pillow talk. It's the opposite of what they used to discredit. They used to tell people in the spy business that if you were gay, people could blackmail you. But this way, it's flipped. They have a gay CIA agent who's out there getting pillow talk from the bad guy and in the end blackmailing the bad guy.
So he's using his manly wiles to get the information.
Yes, he's using his manly wiles. And so that is that's part of the cast of characters in this novel. Most of the novel is told from Jay's point of view, who is the James Bond kind of character with the woman on his arm.
So the gay character is a secondary character.
Yes, gay character is a secondary character. It's really more of a spy novel. I mean, he's there to discover the murder mystery of somebody who's smuggling radiation. But the reader knows who's done the murders and how. And it's really a spy versus spy. With the good spies trying to catch the bad spies.
So I think I can guess what your recommendation is, but what is it?
It's a thrilling recommendation.
That's what I thought, because it sounds like a thriller.
It is definitely a thriller. It's got some mystery in it, because it's a murder mystery, ostensibly, but it's really more of a spy thriller. And it was a Lambda Literary finalist this year in the Gay Mystery category.
And it's Timothy J. Smith?
The Fourth Courier.
The Fourth Courier. Anything by Weird Queer Tales this week?
Oh, you know, Weird Queer Tales is really on hiatus through this shutdown. Bookstores all over the country are closed, and so we're delaying our releases. However, you can pick up a lot of our back catalog. Now is a good time to read some of them quarantines. Black Marble Pool by Stan Leventhal. The Grant Michael series, the Jazz Anderson series by Jack Dixon is now completely released. So there's a lot there to pick up on these days.
And where do they go to find those books?
ReQueeredTales.com.
All right. Sounds like a winner.
I'm looking forward to hearing Charlie Cochran. I really like her Cambridge Fellows book.
Oh, she was a fun interview, so I think you'll enjoy.
Good, thanks.
Okay, see you next week.
See you next week.
If you enjoy Gay Mystery Podcast, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. Because Charlie Cochran couldn't be trusted to do any of the jobs of choice, like managing a rugby team, she writes. Her mystery novels include the Edwardian-era Cambridge Fellows series and the contemporary Lindenshaw mysteries. Multi-published, she has titles with Riptide, Karina, Loom, and Bold Strokes, among others. A member of the Romantic Novelists Association, Mystery People, and International Thriller Writers, Inc., Charlie regularly appears at literary festivals and at reader and author conferences. Hello, Charlie.
Hiya, how you doing?
I'm fabulous. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. Now, when this show goes out, it will be just a few days after the release of Lessons in Following a Poisonous Trail.
Yep.
Now, that's a Cambridge Fellows mystery novella.
That's right.
How many stories have been in the series?
Oh, now you've stumped me now. There's 12 full-length novels, and I think this is now the fifth of the novellas. But there's also a whole lot of small free stories that people can get off my website. So, yes, 17 of various lengths.
So quite a few. You've been doing it for a while.
The first one came out, I think, back end of 2008, which seems like an eternity ago.
Well, that has been, that, you have been doing that for a while.
Yes, yeah, it's kept me out of mischief.
Well, give us a general feeling for the series. I know it started originally, we discussed that it started more of a romance with mystery, and then now it's changed to a mystery with romance. But if you can kind of give us a general feel for the story, that'd be great.
Yes. If I can, I'll take you back to what inspired it, which is a fantastic novel called Death at the President's Lodgings, which came out in the mid-1930s by a guy called Michael Innes. And strangely enough, is set in a fictitious university at Bletchley, which, given the events that were going to happen about 5 or 6 years after this book was published, is totally spooky that that's where you'd put a university. But when I read it, there were one or two incredibly what I'd call slashy scenes between the detective and one of the dons at this fictional university. And I'm sitting reading it thinking, why was there never, it's pretty obvious why there was never a gay couple in one of these golden age mysteries, because clearly homosexuality was still illegal. And I was thinking I'd really like to read a book set then in an Oxbridge type uni with two amateur detectives who also fell in love. And seeing as I couldn't find one anywhere, I had to write my own. So Lessons in Love, which was the first one in that series, started as a romance, and the mystery, the murders and the murders to solve were really just a vehicle to get the two people together. And then I felt that I found myself that I couldn't stop writing them. So as the series has developed, there's still a romantic thread there, but I guess the mysteries have taken the major part. So if you go down through the series, particularly into the novellas, I'd say they're primarily mysteries with a romantic element rather than being romances with a mystery element. But they're all set in and around Cambridge. They're all set in the early 20th century. So starting about 1905 and go through at the moment till about 1921, which is a period of history that I'm particularly interested in.
Well, in a romantic mystery, how do you find the balance when mixing romance with murder?
I think you have to be realistic. I think you always have to try and put yourself in the reader's mind and think, I must make sure that the mystery doesn't get in the way of the romance and the romance doesn't get in the way of the mystery. And I think by weaving it together is what you have to do. So You know, you can't suddenly have, well, this chapter's all mystery and this chapter's all romance. You've got to somehow find a realistic way of doing that. And I think you can, because, you know, if a couple are involved with each other, but they're also involved in doing some detection, then naturally they're going to have a conversation about it over the breakfast table or whatever. So I think you can weave it in. But I think you've always just got to be conscious of who is the reader for this book. So are they looking primarily for the romance, or are they looking primarily for the mystery? And that's what gives you your balance. And I think being totally honest with them about, you know, how you're pitching it, and that perhaps, you know, somebody who's come to the Cambridge Fellows primarily for the romance, they would need to understand that if they're buying the novellas, they're not going to get a lot of the romantic scenes that they might have done otherwise. So, yeah, I think it's just really being conscious of your reader, if that makes any sense.
It makes total sense. In my first novel, I had a blurb about the relationship, and some people took it more strongly than it was and expected much more of a romantic mystery than my story was. So unintentionally, I deceived some individuals. I don't know. It didn't look that strong to me, but that's the way they read it. So now I have blurb right on there that says, this is not a romance. just to make it clear.
And they're always happening, even in the sort of the category. And I'm a huge fan of Golden Age mysteries. So, you know, that early, the end of the 19th century, start of the 20th, and those classic stories that were written there, a lot of them have very, very strong romances in them. And you think about Dorothy L. Sayers with Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane. So an awful lot of people like Agatha Christie, who wrote mysteries, also wrote category romances under a different name. And people like Georgette Heyer did both. There is a very strong thread of people who write in both genres, because actually both genres are very similar in their story arcs.
No, it's interesting. I never knew that about Agatha Christie, that she did write romance novels. So you're saying similar story arcs. Now, in what way do you find them similar?
Because I think it's almost like, you know, the boy meets boy, boy loses boy, boy gets boy back, is the sense of a world made wrong and then made right again. And I think that's exactly the same in a crime novel or a mystery novel. You know, you have your murder and then somebody is trying to solve this. The world has split apart and they're trying to make it right again by coming through to the end with the denouement of who did it. So there's that same sense of the world made right and perhaps an imperfect world made right. I mean, I'm quite convinced that one of the reasons that both romances and mysteries are so very, very popular with readers is that they present the world in perhaps an imperfect world in a way that it will never be, that, you know, you don't always catch the villain. You don't always have a happy ending, but you get them within those two categories of books. And I think that's why readers love them. It's that same sense of satisfaction of you reach the end and you go, well, that's great. It's all good now.
Well, you write the Lindenshaw mysteries, and those are contemporary.
That's right.
And then we've been talking about the Cambridge Fellow mysteries, which are set in the Edwardian era.
That's correct.
What is it about that time era that enticed you?
Oh, I think because I've just read so many books that were set there, and I think that's initially it. You know, huge fan of Conan Doyle, Jerome K. Jerome, the Raffles books. So reading from that era, it almost feels natural to write in that era. And it's quite odd because I find myself going into a sort of almost Jerome K. Jerome mode. And there was one review, and I can't remember where, that was probably the most satisfying review I've had for the Cambridge Fellows books, which said, not only does it sound authentic, but it almost sounds as if these books were written in 1910. And I thought, results, you know, that's just great. So I think it's the interest in that era comes primarily from from the books that I've read. But I'm also incredibly interested in World War One and the history of the people who took part in that conflict and the effects it had upon them longer term. And a total aside, but I used to be a school governor and got my hands on the record books from one of the little local schools. And the guy who was the head teacher there, and he kept a sort of daily book, he went off to fight and then he had shell shock and was in one of the local military hospitals and then came back to be head teacher of the school. And something that will always stick with me to my dying day is how his handwriting changed. This very confident hand written in 1913, and his handwriting in 1919 is like that of an old man. It's spidery. And it's just that effect on those young people's lives and how it changed them, I just find absolutely fascinating. So, yeah, that's why that era is just so interesting.
So it sounds like you do a lot of research for that time period.
Yes, I do. I mean, what I don't do is look at what battles took place when. I mean, if I need to know those, I'll go to Wikipedia. But I do read an awful lot of stuff about like diaries from the time or letters from the time or people's accounts of the. I'm very interested in the people as opposed to the basic facts of battles and dates.
Now, what have you faced any particular challenges in writing about that era?
I think sometimes it's about getting the really trivial little bits. You know, everybody knows the big bits of history, but it's the tiny little details, like, you know, perhaps how much something cost. One of the sources that I really like are newspapers from the time, either real ones or reproduction ones, because they capture those tiny little things that wouldn't make it into a history book. So I love reading old adverts because, you know, then you'll find out how much a pen cost or, you know, how much the weekly wage was for something or other. You know, what was on at the theatre in London in 1912. So it's finding those trivial details that are important. Although having said that, I think it's equally important to research your contemporary novels, because, you know, if you get something wrong in a historical, you know, perhaps Two Men and Their Dog will realize and they'll give you a hard time because you've used the word blizzard in a Regency novel set in England, and actually blizzard is an American word from the late 19th century. But if you get something wrong in a contemporary novel, an awful lot of people are going to know about it. So, you know, when I talk to aspiring writers, I say please research as much, if not more so, for something contemporary than for something historical.
It's easy to miss. I would never have known that about Blizzard, and that would be something I could easily miss. There's where others, I think I've said on the show before, I read a story that was written in the Victorian era where they said they were going to a cocktail party. That immediately threw me off completely. I don't even know if I finished the book after that.
Although you say that, but actually sometimes things surprise you. I've got a mental list of all sorts of surprising things that I really would like to work into a novel so that somebody would say, oh, you can't have that. They didn't have floodlit rugby matches in, you know, 1885. And I could go, well, yes, they did.
Well, similar to that is if you remember, what's the movie that starred Russell Crowe with the Gladiator? Gladiator.
Gladiator, yeah.
Gladiators during their time period were like sports stars during this time period.
Yeah.
They promoted products and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they originally put that in the movie and they took it out because they said nobody would believe it.
Believe it, yeah.
You know, that gladiators would do endorsements.
Yes.
So I found that very interesting.
Didn't the women apply, because they used to sort of, they didn't have soap, but they used olive oil, didn't they? So they put the olive oil on the gladiators and get a stridule to, you know, scrape it off. And the women used to buy it and wear it as scent, their favourite gladiator's sweat, which I just think is both wonderful and hideous at the same time.
Well, I don't know whose job it was to put the oil on, but I would have volunteered. But
get in the queue, son, because you're behind me, I tell you. It's funny, we were talking before it started about, you know, research, and there's nothing as a reader that makes me disconnect with a book more than a really bad, I mean, I think, you know, Blizzard's acceptable, I'll say that because it was my mistake that I'm referring to, but sometimes there are horrendous mistakes in books, like you say, Cocktail Party, that just make you disconnect with it. But actually, as readers, we swallow a huge lie every time we pick up a crime book, particularly a crime book set in United Kingdom, because, you know, they are just full of multiple murders, usually happening in some beautiful leafy little village. And that simply does not happen over here. It's incredibly rare. But, you know, if you're an alien coming down from out of space and your only reference were, British cozy mystery books and British mystery series, I mean, you wouldn't want to go to Oxford for a start, because it's clearly the murder capital of the universe. So it's that really strange thing about, we're trying to present a world that's as real as possible, so we do all our research. But the basic tenet upon which it is based, which is that these multiple murders happen frequently, is complete and utter nonsense. But, you know, we accept it, don't we, as readers?
It's nonsense and a lot of fun at the same time.
Absolutely.
Well, even here in the States, where our murder rate is quite a bit higher, I have not stumbled on a body every week.
You're not Jessica Fletcher.
No, I'm not Jessica Fletcher, and nor would I want to be a friend of hers.
No.
Well, we're going to pause for a moment.
Yeah.
Because we're going to do awkward questions that authors get.
Oh, heck.
Okay. What I do is I spin the wheel, and a question will come up, and it's sometimes they're bizarre, sometimes they're just questions that are difficult for us to answer.
Okay, well, so, I'll gird my loins and get myself ready.
Okay, so give me a second here. We're going to spin the wheel right now. Okay. Yours is, I don't know if it's a tough one. We'll just say maybe it's kind of rude. Charlie,
yes.
Charlie, are your books any good?
Oh, well, that's sort of set like asking, are my daughters pretty? Because, you know, how could I ever say that they're not? But I think, like most authors, I would love to say, yeah, my books are really good. Give them a try. They might be right up your street. But perhaps, like most Brits, I'm very reticent about blowing my own trumpet. I think the only honest answer I can give to that is sometimes I go through a first draft and go, this is complete and utter tat, and why the hell did I write any of it? But then sometimes I come across something I wrote years ago and I think, this is really quite good. Did I really write it? So that doesn't answer your question, but I think it's the best you're going to get.
I think the number of readers you have answers your question.
Well, that's
you have a good following. And if your books weren't any good, then you wouldn't have the following that you do.
I appreciate that, Brad. And I think certainly for me, it's when I get an email from a reader, and I do get a few, particularly from the more mature gay male, and just when they've said that the story's meant something to her, it's connected with them, that, you know, that absolutely makes my day, week, month, whatever. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Oh, well, I would also say that it is a good feeling when you, especially if you're feeling down about your writing and you're thinking, maybe I'm not such a great writer. And like you said, you read something that you wrote in the past and you're like, I would read this.
Yeah.
And it's such a good feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you sometimes find something from your very early writing days and you think, I would never read this if you paid me £100. Well,
I've got quite a few of those in the drawer that will never see the light of day.
Yeah.
Back to research. What is one of the most surprising things you've learned in your research?
Oh, well, it always surprises me. The past continues to surprise me, particularly when it's counterintuitive. And this wasn't particular research for a book that I was doing, but I was reading about Agincourt. And I was just getting a bit of background about, I think, fighting men and their motivation and their thoughts. And it's a really good book by Juliet Barker called Agincourt. And what I learned in there was that at the time of that battle, which I think was 1415, and it may not have been, somebody's probably going to be shouting at this podcast right now saying, Charlie, that's ridiculous. but they had female blacksmiths. So if you were a male blacksmith and you were a widower, you were allowed to have an extra apprentice blacksmith because you didn't have your wife working for you. Now, that runs counter to everything that I've been told as a woman about how women weren't allowed these jobs and they were terribly repressed and, you know, they had to just stay in the home. No, there were women blacksmiths. And there was also supposed to be a saying at the time that the nails for the crucifixion were made by a female blacksmith because men would have been too soft-hearted to make them. And for, I just was completely blown away by that as a fact, because it just, yeah, it's just had to make me reevaluate all I thought I understood about the role of women in the past.
Well, it certainly makes sense. I mean, life was hard. So
absolutely.
You know, you needed everybody to jump in.
Yeah.
So it's surprising to me as well to hear you say that, but when I think about it, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I'd have liked to have met some of these female blacksmiths on a dark night in a small alley, but, you know.
No, you probably would lose the battle if there was a fight. Now, you attend a lot of conferences and festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And you interact with many of your fellow authors as well as your readers.
Mm-hmm.
What do you gain from those interactions?
All sorts of things. I mean, I think you learn continually. I think if you ever stop learning about anything, not just about, you know, reading, not about reading and writing, but I think if you do stop learning, well, you might as well just, you know, put yourself in your coffin and get buried, because I think it's really important to always have an open mind to take in new things. So I learn an awful lot, not just from fellow authors, but from readers. I also find I learn a lot about everything. The most recent one I've been to was the Portsmouth Book Fest. And I did two sessions there. One was as a romance author and one was Mystery Fest. And we had the most amazing speaker. And she was a professor of psychology from Portsmouth University. And she advised the British police and police worldwide about their investigation techniques and about their interviewing techniques. And she was great because she said every time she watches a television show a cop show on the TV, she just shouts at it the whole time saying, well, that's wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong. And what I had not understood was that actually you don't talk about interrogations anymore within the British police force. There is not a sense of, well, I think he or she is the person who done it, so we're going to go all out to prove that they did it. It's a much more open-minded, much more stuff around getting rapport from witnesses. And the thing that surprised me is that in most, you know, contrary to what you see in television programs like CSI, certainly within the British system, only 15% of the evidence on average in a case is forensic. All the rest is on witness testimony. And it's things like that you think, I would never have known that if I hadn't rocked up at, you know, and gone along to this conference and sat and listened to people who are experts in their field talking. So I think primarily what you get out of it is learning experiences that you couldn't get anywhere else.
Well, I think CSI is a prime example of everything that doesn't happen in investigation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for those that don't live in the States, I've never seen a police department look as clean and modern and high tech as what you will see on CSI.
They are, and I know somebody who's a CSI over here, and it's nothing like that. I mean, yeah. police forces over here don't have the budget to do most of the investigating that these guys do anyway.
Right. It's fun to watch, but except that you're not watching reality.
No. It's fantasy.
Now, are there any cons with interacting with your readers?
I think sometimes there are so odd things happen. I think generally readers are really nice and they ask some really interesting, really thoughtful questions. The problem sometimes happens, and it isn't just at cons or festivals, is when the person sidles up to you and says they've got an idea for a book and then they want to tell you all about it. And you very politely suggest that perhaps they might like to write this book themselves, but they never have time and they couldn't possibly do it, but they want to tell you all about it themselves. And there's part of me that, you know, I try and nod politely and, oh, yeah, that's really interesting, and try and encourage them that, you know, well, all you've got to do is write 500 words a day and you'll have a very long novel by the end of the year. Oh, no, could possibly do that. But I think there's always the worry that they're going to tell you this plot for the book and then somehow 2 years down the line it'll appear in one of your own books because you've forgotten this conversation. And then you're going to find yourself in a lawsuit. Oh, you stole my idea. So it's not a huge downside, but I think it's a genuine worry that, somebody might just happen to share a story with you and you take it on board. I understand that Andrew Lloyd Webber does not listen to anybody else's music because then he can't be accused of plagiarism. But I think that's the only downside. I think generally readers and other authors are absolutely delightful.
Yeah, it's an easy downside because we don't generally know where our ideas come from all the time.
No.
And so it could be something that you heard just in a sentence years ago. And,
yeah.
You know, somebody plants that little seed and next thing you know, you could have a lawsuit on your hands. So
yeah.
Good point. Now, while most of your novels have gone through traditional publishing, The Right Chair Press is your own publishing imprint. Okay. What has been your experience like as an indie author now?
Again, it's been a learning curve. I mean, you know, I'm hardly in my first flush of youth. Actually, it's been really good for me to have to learn new skills and learn new word processing skills or whatever to, you know, put together print editions. So I've really enjoyed it. The downside is always, particularly for me, is the marketing. Because, you know, I don't like necessarily blowing my own trumpet. And the marketing is hard work. And I think increasingly, you know, it's something that I've seen change in, you know, the 12 years since I was published. There are a huge number of authors, which is great. You know, there are many more books available. But it does make it more difficult, I think, for authors who've been around a while. And I think a number of people are saying actually, sales are dropping or their percentage of the market is dropping. So particularly with a lot of people doing self-publishing, either of new works or of revised work or reissued works, that actually we're all going after the same bit of market share. And I think perhaps what we're not doing, and this is, you know, as part of the experience, something that I'm very keen if we can, is we need to get new readers into the genre because, you know, if you've got more authors and it's basically the same lot of readers that it was 10 years ago, everybody's going to be getting a smaller share of sales and some very good books and some very good authors don't get the sales that they deserve. And simply because, you know, the readership aren't aware that they're around. So I'm very keen as either as an independent author or a self-published or with, you know, a bigger publisher, that we need to be getting out and getting more people to appreciate, books that have LGBT content.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I started this podcast. And I don't think it's just that there aren't enough books or enough readers to go around. I think a lot of us just don't need to be heard, that, you know, that the readers that do exist generally are avid readers and would like to read more, but they don't know what else is out there.
Yeah, so, I agree.
So I would love it if you, your readers listen in and find another author that they love as well. And other readers have listened in will hear you and say, oh, that she sounds like she'd be a great author. So spread it out a little bit, but also we need new readers as well all the time.
Absolutely. And something that I've found, you know, a lot of the sort of festivals or whatever that I go to are like mainstream. There aren't LGBT in particular. And there are lots of people out there who, particularly with the crime books, perhaps not necessarily with the category romances, because perhaps that is at the moment a step too far. But a lot of people who would not necessarily read a gay romance will read a mystery that has gay romance in it just as part of the story, because actually they're more interested in the mystery. And I think there is a huge market potentially out there that perhaps we're not quite, as you say, we're not quite getting into.
I think you have a very good point there. And also as far as marketing, artists in general don't like to market themselves.
No.
And I think that is especially true of those from the UK, your neck of the woods, and Australians. It's hard for us to sell ourselves, especially because we want to be writing.
Well, yes. I think you do. I don't know if you begrudge the time that you spend marketing, but you're right. It's not as much fun as the putting together a story is. But I think we Brits in particular, I think the Aussies are very similar, that it's just, you know, it might be quite nice if you bought my book, please, but, you know, please don't put yourself out to do it.
I apologize, but would you like my book?
it's quite nice, really. Just I'll pass a few minutes. Whatever. It's not too offensive.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Well, Charlie, I can't believe that this time has whizzed by.
Oh gosh, yeah.
It's been a quick 30 minutes. You've been delightful to talk to. I could continue.
Oh yeah, I've really enjoyed myself, Brad. Thank you. It's been good.
Well, thank you for being a guest on the show, and perhaps we can have you on again later when you bring out some new novels.
Absolutely. Yeah. At any time you want somebody to come along and be silly on a podcast, you know, I'm your girl.
Well, there you go. I love silly. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brad.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show, so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.